The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system, improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not so long ago, when journalists and political operatives used Rolodexes, Fergus Cullen's name was in all of them. The former chairman of New Hampshire's Republican Party was one of the go-to people for a quick read or quote on the First in the Nation primary. Well, politics has changed since then. The state's primary is now a national battleground, with outside interest groups and PACs spending millions to target voters. But even in an election, when anyone with a Twitter handle can command the stage, Fergus Cullen remains a go-to guy with a canny institutional memory. Well, today we're mining stories of primaries past from his book, Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. Fergus Cullen, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a very generous introduction.
Oh,
thank
well, you.
You
know. Well, you know, I grew up in New Hampshire, too, and it's sort of like growing up an Eskimo around snow. You know, it's always there. When did you first become aware of the primary and what it meant in national politics?
Boy, 1988, I was a sophomore at Guilford, New Hampshire High School, and it was an open seat that year. I went around to see Republicans, Democrats, wherever they were. I had my driver's license and went around with some buddies, and ever since, I've been hooked on the New Hampshire primary.
Well, Granite Steps, this covers six presidential primaries from 1992 to 2012, years when Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama were elected presidents, but not victorious in the New Hampshire contest. So this begs the question whether the state's claim, always first, always right, still applies.
Yeah, that was the watch phrase of the primary for its first several decades until Bill Clinton lost in New Hampshire. You know, he called himself the comeback kid. People tend to forget sometimes that Paul Tsongas was, in fact, the strong winner that night. But he became president, and ever since it hasn't had the same stake in terms of always first, always right. But a win here or performing well still matters. It is still a level playing field where all candidates, regardless of their name recognition or financial resources, get an equal opportunity to succeed. Now, they don't all succeed. In fact, most of them do fail, but they all go home defeated or otherwise and say, you know, I had my shot and New Hampshire is what gave me that chance.
Well, it's funny that you identify Bill Clinton as an outsider. He's an insurgent back in 92.
Yeah, you know, back in 1992, Democrats had lost 5 out of 6 of the previous presidential elections, and Bill Clinton started his campaign saying, we need to change as Democrats. If we nominate another unelectable liberal in the model of Walter Mondale or Michael Dukakis, we're going to lose. And that was his strong new Democratic message. Now, it all got swallowed up in questions of character. That all happened here in New Hampshire. When the Jennifer Flowers story broke, Bill Clinton was in New Hampshire in Nashua that day talking on a senior citizens forum. When the draft letter broke, he was here in New Hampshire that day as well. Everything that happened to Bill Clinton happened in New Hampshire, and the voters here were thrust into the role of jury.
Well, it's so interesting because if in the national media, this spelled the end for his campaign, those two revelations. How did New Hampshire voters react, and how does that distinguish them?
Well, he survived here, and he showed his tremendous resilience. You know, even on the day when Bill Clinton did the famous 60 Minutes interview, that was taped, by the way, on a Sunday morning in a Ritz-Carlton in Boston. The night before, Clinton and Hillary had done a rally at the YMCA in Manchester. Then they went down to Boston, taped the show. After the taping of the show, Hillary flew back to Arkansas, and Bill Clinton came to Portsmouth and did a town hall meeting at the Frank Jones Center. And C-SPAN was there covering the event, so you can see the footage. And, you know, just the tremendous pressure he must have been under that day. And he just hits it out of the park at this thing. You know, a woman questioner halfway through the thing, you know, gets up to ask a question and says, look, you know, are you going to be admitting adultery? And he's, you know, the crowd boos and he calms them down. down, and he says, no, listen, you know, it's a fair question. He says, I'd like to ask you to watch 60 Minutes tonight, and that's all I'm going to say. Mm. And, you know, it's just, it was just, you know, he confronted the voters directly, and they gave him a second lease on life.
Right. He was the comeback kid. So what do you think his view of New Hampshire voters is?
Well, you know, he clearly does love New Hampshire. I mean, he wrote it in his book, but you can tell by his actions since he left the White House. He had a very nostalgic trip to New Hampshire in his last week as president, in fact, where he went to Dover, where he'd given that famous Last Dog Dies speech at the Dover Elks. And he walked Elm Street with Gene Shaheen and others who had been around at the time. Shaheen, by the way, not a supporter of Bill Clinton in 1992. She was a Bob Kerry supporter. And she said at the time, you know, look, she had been with Gary Hart during the 1980s. And she said, been there, done that.
Right.
And this was before the revolutions. But she had heard rumors. She had concerns about him. And she went with Bob Kerry.
Yeah. Well, that was the same year, of course, that George H.W. Bush, the incumbent president, was also running. Early on, the union leader said he's going to waltz into this presidency unless he fell flat on his face. Did not go too smoothly, which you attribute to being caught in between two New Hampshire political dynasties, the Sununus and the Greggs. First, a little background on why the two sides and how it played out on the trail.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So so Hugh Gregg had been governor in New Hampshire for one term back in the 50s as a young man, but continued to be a political power broker here for decades. In 1976, Hugh had been with Ronald Reagan, and he lost. But in 1980, Hugh made a mistake, if you will. He dumped Reagan and went for George H.W. Bush when he was a candidate. Well, Reagan wins New Hampshire, of course, into that famous I'm paying for this microphone moment. But that gave Hugh Gregg a relationship with George H.W. Bush that was stronger than anyone else's in New Hampshire because he had, you know, abandoned Reagan for him. Well, fast forward, you know, 1988, George H.W. Bush wins the New Hampshire primary. The governor at the time, John Sununu, getting a lot of credit for that. The Gregg family feeling a little slighted, like they had been doing a lot of the work over the time. But John H. Sununu became White House chief of staff and really was controlling the Bush operation. Now, George H.W. Bush was not expected to get a challenge in 1992. We think of these presidential campaigns lasting a year with candidates coming here. Pat Buchanan showed up 10 weeks before the primary, walked into the legislative office building in Concord, declared his candidacy, and it was a 10-week campaign that very quickly focused on economic misery and whether George H.W. Bush was more concerned about foreign affairs than domestic matters at home.
And, of course, Sununu had been the one who negotiated the tax that came up in the Read My Lips.
That's right. In 1988, H.W. Bush gets elected on the Read My Lips, no new taxes pledge, breaks it, and that became, of course, the albatross politically around his neck that Pat Buchanan hung on him during that campaign.
The same year, Naki Loeb she drafted Pat Buchanan into the race, didn't she?
She did. She ran an editorial saying, run, Pat, run, in November, you know, welcoming in. And the union leader supported Buchanan very strongly in 1992. Also, again, in 1996 when Buchanan ran. You know, so in 92, Buchanan gets 37% of the vote as a protest against George H.W. Bush. Comes back, runs a second time in 96. His market share fell to 28%, but he won the primary because the Republican establishment was splintered. Sound familiar, Virginia? Something similar may be happening this
cycle? Well, I'm actually thinking, you know, he's a fiscal and social conservative, you know, former Nixon staffer, former Reagan staffer. Rhetoric not so unlike the kind of insurgent candidates that we're hearing about today. Do you think Pat Buchanan's time came too late? How do you think he would have fared in this election?
Well, the original Tea Partier was Pat Buchanan. Yeah. You know, people with pitchforks for Pat. You know, he was anti-free trade. He was anti-immigration, legal or otherwise. He was very populist. So, you know, here we are 20 years later, and we see some of the same themes having resonance with at least a quarter of the Republican electorate. Mm-hmm. Now, Buchanan came back a third time and ran again in 2000, but this time his time had passed. He was unable to generate much enthusiasm, ended up quitting the Republican Party and trying to run for his president on the Reform Party ticket. His time had come and gone.
I'm talking with Fergus Cullen. He's former chairman of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. When we come back, we'll leave the 90s behind. We'll talk about the campaigns of George W. Bush and Barack Obama and how retail politics has and has not changed in the new millennium. Stick around for more stories when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR, and I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, we're in the waning weeks of a heated primary season and reflecting on some primaries past with Fergus Cullen. His book, Granite Steps, uncovers some of the stumbles and surprises and successes and distinctive character and characters of the New Hampshire primary. Before the break, we talked about Bill Clinton, Pat Buchanan, and the politics of the 90s. Well, we're on to a new century now, okay? So George W. Bush, he's in a field of 11 candidates, not an exuberant candidate, let's just say. How did New Hampshire voters view that compared to his chief competitors, John McCain and Steve Forbes?
Yeah, so George W. Bush came in as a huge front runner in New Hampshire, and then he blew it, went about New Hampshire all wrong. He skipped two debates in November that year, one at Dartmouth and one at UNH, because he felt he didn't need to do that kind of stuff. And he had been so successful at thinning the field that year that it ended up spelling his own demise, at least in New Hampshire. So there were 11 candidates or something like that. John Kasich was running, dropped out in July. Lamar Alexander was running, dropped out in August. Dan Quayle drops out in September. Elizabeth Dole drops out in October because Bush was cleaning up all the money and they ran out of fumes. So by the time the fall came around, if you weren't excited about George W. Bush, your viable options on the Republican side were let down to two: Steve Forbes, who had run once before and wasn't very charismatic, and John McCain. And what happened was John McCain started consolidating the support of all the dropouts and, of course, doing 114 town hall meetings in New Hampshire, where George W. Bush was sort of blowing voters off here, much more likely to speak to a Chamber of Commerce group than a Republican group, and he ended up paying a huge price for it with the voters.
Which speaks to McCain's talent for retail politics, obviously, but I noticed that year, just before the primary, Thomas Oliphant, writing in the Boston Globe, noted a shift from retail politics to wholesale. What was going on?
Yeah, and that's what's only accelerated. You know, the idea that the town hall meetings, it's nice to have 100 people in the audience, but they're really starting to play to the cameras. And all we've seen is that increase. You know, I mentioned how we didn't even have Fox News until the 2000 cycle. In fact, their first debate was the UNH debate. It was George W. Bush's first debate as well in December of 1999. It got the highest ratings ever in the history of that young network in 3 years. And you just see the light bulbs going off in executives' heads saying, hey, this is great.
We found our audience.
We did. And now, of course, they're promoting the debates like it's an NFL football game, and they're getting ratings to match.
Well, McCain, of course, perfected this town hall meeting style, and it had appeal as a real and genuine politician, but wasn't really able to leverage that into the national election. So does that speak to the importance of retail politics in New Hampshire?
I think it still is critical. You know, a candidate, no amount of money here can make up for a candidate who simply can't sell in front of a Rotary group and do a town hall meeting. And this was Steve Forbes' problem, right? I mean, he was, you know, a good conservative, had good ideas, but plenty of money, but he just didn't have any common touch, and he just couldn't sell. And you watch the films of him, you know, speaking to a group, and it's painful to watch how awkward he is. And so no amount of money was able to paper that over. And that's still true today. You know, whether it's Marco Rubio running or John Edwards in recent cycles, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, if they don't have that ability, they're going to fail as candidates. And after New Hampshire, of course, it's all TV green rooms. You know, what can you do in 30 seconds on TV? And you can make up for a lot of deficits in your skill set. But in New Hampshire, the truth is going to come out.
Okay, we're at the close of a heated primary season and reflecting on primaries past with Fergus Cullen. He is former chair of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of the book Granite Steps: Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. I couldn't help but think in the general election that year when I saw New Hampshire go blue for Barack Obama, that had to hurt John McCain. Do you think that actual personal connection happens for politicians?
I do. I mean, I was state party chairman at the time, and there was the sense that New Hampshire had a special connection with John McCain, and he did lose it in the general. But, you know, New Hampshire gave him a second chance again. You know, he was flat on his back in July of 2007 and crawled back here. I happened to be live in the audience for one of my favorite moments in the New Hampshire primary in Wolfboro that summer with John McCain. I lived lived in Wolfboro at the time, and there was a Gold Star mother who lived in the community. Her name is Lynn Savage. And she, you know, this was when McCain had no staff, you know, and several of us locals recognized Mrs. Savage come into the room and say, oh, you know, there's Mrs. Savage. But John McCain had no idea, you know, she's just another person in the audience. And halfway through, she gets up to ask him a question, and she basically said, you know, Senator McCain, I lost my son in Iraq. Please tell me that he gave his life for a purpose, that his life was not wasted in vain. And would you wear this bracelet in memory of my son? His name was Matthew Stanley. And you can see John McCain again. C-SPAN, I was there live, but C-SPAN also covered this, so the footage is available. You know, he gets a little hitch. He walks up to her. He says, yes, ma'am, I would be honored. He accepts the bracelet. He walks back, asks her, how old was Matthew when he died? And, you know, she responds, 20 or 21. He says, yes, ma'am, I would be honored to wear this bracelet. He takes a deep breath, and he goes on with the town hall meeting. And it was just this unique moment. You know, as I was putting together the book, I came across three incidents in New Hampshire over the years where voters had come up to John McCain and said, I wore a bracelet for you when you were a POW in Vietnam. That must have happened to John McCain much more often than that. So it was just this real poignant human moment, and it happened in Wolfboro.
Right, and a genuine moment.
Yes.
And of course, this is a big question about, you know, the authenticity of politicians. And that brings us to the 2008 election with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton running against each other. Tied in the polls just until the actual primary day. That was the day after Hillary Clinton had her famous crying moment in Portsmouth. What do you think? Decisive moment for real?
I do. So Hillary Clinton, not only does she lose Iowa, she comes in third in Iowa. And that year, the New Hampshire primary was just 5 days later. And she came into New Hampshire, and three things happened that weekend that really strengthened her, especially, I think, with women voters. One was the you're likable enough moment in a debate at St. Anselm College. Scott Spradling, well-known to people in New Hampshire, asked a question about likability, and Hillary just hits it out of the park and is interrupted by Barack Obama icily saying, you're likable enough, Hillary. A real mistake for him. And then on the Monday morning, the day before the primary, Hillary Clinton wakes up, fires her campaign manager by email. Talk about icy. That wasn't public at the time. We found that out later. And then travels to Cafe Espresso on Islington Street in Portsmouth for this roundtable with allegedly undecided voters. And a woman asks her a deceptively simple question, you know, how do you do it? And Mrs. Clinton seems to nearly break down. Her voice certainly wavers. And she says, you know, it's hard. And she gives this two-minute answer where she appeared to almost be on the verge of tears. And it really humanized her. You know, one of her challenges is that she's been a little bit cold and over the years, a little bit robotic. And that played on a loop for the 24 hours going into that primary. And I think it was part of why she ended up beating Barack Obama here by a couple of points.
I think it really swayed some votes. Well, okay, we can't go through all of these elections, but I'm thinking about, you know, John Kerry. He went to St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire. Mitt Romney had a home on Winnipesaukee. Do you think that actually makes a difference to New Hampshire voters? I mean, they see candidates coming in from all over the country. Does that New Hampshire connection matter?
Well, I think it's been a head start for a lot of candidates, especially if they come out of Massachusetts and the Boston media market. You know, lots of people are getting their TV news from Boston TV stations. They're rooting for Boston sports teams. The Boston Globe has the biggest circulation of any newspaper in New Hampshire. So that gives them a head start if they've been in the news in the Massachusetts media market. But it hasn't been enough in and of itself. But I think people do like that. You know, I like to think that Abraham Lincoln is the one who made the first in the nation primary appearance here back in 1860 when his son Robert was a student at Phillips Exeter Academy. And he, you know, Abraham Lincoln, he gave this speech, Cooper Union Address in New York, and I'll just go up to New Hampshire and visit my son and, oh, by the way, give a couple of speeches. And he spoke in Dover and in Concord and in Exeter on that trip.
All right, so what I'm hearing, Fergus, lessons. Show up. Get the right family on your side. Be personable. Maybe cry. I mean, do these still work? Do they still apply in this you know, ultra-mediated age when anybody can comment about what's going on in the primary in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, I think the primary does evolve. I mean, I talked about how the advent of cable TV has changed things and of course, the internet. And we never maybe expected social media. You know, Facebook launched a week after John Kerry won the 2004 primary in a Harvard dorm. And of course, 8 years later, even when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton ran, Facebook was still not widely adopted. And today now, voters are sort of building their own personal echo chambers. Have you ever unfriended somebody on Facebook because you disagreed with them politically? I mean, lots of people have. And so, it's always evolving and always changing. But fundamentally, a candidate still has to be able to connect with real voters. They can't fake it and they can't make shortcuts.
Fergus, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
Fergus Cullen, he is former chair of New Hampshire's Republican Party and author of the book Granite Steps, Stumbles, Surprises, and Successes Along the New Hampshire Primary Trail. There's a link to more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1964, Republican Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. won the New Hampshire primary, though it was Barry Goldwater who eventually won his party's nomination for president. Running against both of them was Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman from a major party to run for president. This profile of Senator Smith comes to us from producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries.
There are those who make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world and that it should be kept that way.
My name is Janann Sherman, and I wrote the book No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
My name is Merton Henry, and in 1964, I worked on the Margaret Chase Smith presidential campaign.
Margaret Chase Smith was born in a little town in central Maine called Skowhegan. Her mother struggled working in the shoe factory, working as a waitress and so forth. So it was not an easy life. And I think that was the basis for a lot of Margaret's ambition, that she didn't want to end up like her mother had. She had better ideas for herself.
She was the first woman ever elected to the Senate in her own right. She was very much a middle-of-the-road Republican who really followed her own instincts on things.
She definitely was seen by 1964 as a hawk.
It does not pay to play footsie with the communists.
She was probably the only woman in 1964 that had the stature to be a serious candidate for president.
It is contended that I should not run for president because the odds are too heavily against me for even the most remote chance of victory.
In January 1964, Margaret Chase Smith was scheduled to make a regular speech to the Women's Press Club.
Third, it is contended that as a woman, I would not have the physical stamina and strength to run. So because of these very impelling reasons against my running, I have decided that I shall.
So that was the opening shot.
Margaret, Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, the first woman to announce a serious bid for the White House, who will enter the New Hampshire presidential primary on March 10th.
All out for Margaret, the senator from the wonderful state of Maine.
She campaigned in Illinois, she campaigned some in Oregon. She campaigned in small towns before Rotary clubs. She drove both places by car.
She would not accept campaign contributions, so she had no money, no poll workers, no buttons, no bumper stickers. Goldwater and Rockefeller, her opponents, were both millionaires. So I think she decided to take the moral high ground by saying, you don't have to be a millionaire to be president of the United States.
From Washington, D.C., Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, will face the nation.
She tried to get people to pay attention to her record, what she had done of substance, not the fact that she was a woman. But, of course, she was constantly asked that. I mean, it's the very first thing that people see.
Senator Smith, not all countries have the same attitudes towards women as the United States. How do you think a woman president of the United States would make out in international conferences and those so-called nose-to-nose meetings?
Well, I would remind you that once there was Catherine the Great. I would remind you that there was Queen Victoria. I would also call your attention to Mr. Khrushchev's references to me through the years, when he called me an Amazon warmonger hiding behind a rose.
Well, how do you think you would make out in a kitchen confrontation with Mr. Khrushchev?
Well, I wouldn't care to estimate that. If it was making blueberry muffins, I probably would win.
We are well aware of that, Senator, from having sampled them.
She was always having to walk that tightrope between being strong enough and tough enough to be commander-in-chief, to run a country, but still feminine enough and ladylike enough, because being feminine was absolutely essential. And so she tried to balance it the best way she knew how.
Leave it to the girl where there's the frill.
She was always meticulously dressed. She was very careful about her appearance and everything.
She would tell Time magazine that nothing clears her mind like vacuuming, or pose with a mixing bowl, or primping in a mirror. That was a favorite. Senator Smith had a campaign song called Leave It to the Girls.
We'll wear perfume and pearls, be diplomatic in pink curls.
The response from the press was not pretty. One of the pundits said that a woman could be president just as long as she didn't act like one. The press never treated her as if she had a realistic shot at it.
Good afternoon. This is the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Before this day is out, the nominee of the Republican Party will have been determined.
I am now proud and honored to nominate the senior senator from the great Republican state of Maine, Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
You know, she knew at that point that she was not going to get the nomination, to say the least. Goldwater had the nomination pretty much sewed up.
And there it is. Senator Barry Goldwater is the Republican Party's nominee for the presidency of the United States.
The standard is, if you're the loser and you don't have enough delegates to swing it, well, then you very graciously release your delegates to vote for other candidates. But Senator Smith never released them. And the total of the 27 votes that she got on the floor, she hung on to, denying Barry Goldwater the unanimous vote for the nomination. So she came in second.
The tumult and the shouting has died. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the lady from Maine, has emerged from her precedent-breaking bid for the presidency with even greater stature and reputation. Let's get around to this. You made some history, lovely lady, in being the first woman ever nominated.
Yes, it's quite a satisfaction today to think about.
Why do it at all? People run because they want to prove a point. They run because they want to make a statement. They run because they've got an oversized ego or something. There are all sorts of reasons that people run for president, even though they may know they have little chance of winning. Her reason was to prove that a woman could be a serious presidential candidate. And she did. She proved it.
Will we see a woman elected president of the United States during our lifetime? Perhaps not so wild a dream. The world is changing rapidly. Politics change with it. Many of the once impossible things have happened. Time alone will tell if a woman will someday break the tradition that only men can hold that office.
And that piece was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. 30 years ago, the discovery of a hole in the ozone layer made news the world over.
Recently, scientists discovered a weak spot in the ozone layer over Antarctica, the icy continent at the South Pole. Satellite photos show that a hole opens for a few months during Antarctica's springtime.
The bleak news prompted panic and eventually a ban on chemicals used in aerosol sprays. So what happened to the hole purported to expose Earthlings to the sun's blinding and scorching rays? And did it change public response to warnings by scientists and environmentalists? Aaron Blakemore blogs daily for Smithsonian.com and wrote about what happened to the super scary ozone hole. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how bad was the hole in the ozone?
Well, given that ozone protects us from the sun and absorbs the sun's UV rays, the fact that there was any depletion of the ozone was already pretty bad. But when scientists discovered that much more ozone had been depleted than they even suspected, they started to panic.
So how scary were the threats?
I would say they were more scary to the public than to scientists. People didn't really understand, you know, we had just discovered it. So it wasn't clear, all right, what will this cause? How is this going to affect people on Earth? How, you know, severe will this be in terms of human consequences? And so people kind of flipped out. They began to wring their hands and say, you know, this is something we've created. This is a problem of our own making. And it really fed into kind of public panic about the ozone. And I'm a child of the 80s, and I remember probably doing 6 to 8 units on the ozone hole during my elementary school career alone. It really became kind of the symbol of what we as a, you know, society, as humankind, were doing to our environment.
I'm seeing from your report, it's like AIDS from the sky, a terrified environmentalist said. Rumors of sheep going blind. And originally, this was thought to be a mission, supersonic aircraft, but discovered to be something much more pedestrian. What?
It was our hairspray, our shaving cream, our refrigerators, really common chemicals used as propellants called CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. And I think that's maybe plays into why people became so spooked, you know, realizing that really what was thought of as scientific progress, you know, great, I can spray my shaving cream more effectively, I can, you know, squirt a bunch of Aquanet over my head, that those advances actually were potentially going to hurt humans. And one of my favorite reports I read preparing for this article was people getting really upset about the potential damage to the scientists themselves who were researching ozone levels in Antarctica. There was a lot of confusion and concern about, you know, what's going to happen to these people's eyes? What about their skin? You know, are they all going to come back from Antarctica with cancer? And is this something that we have done, essentially?
Wow. Well, here's a commercial. This is from the 1970s, listing no CFCs or chlorofluorocarbons among the 5 reasons for the superior nature of Final Net hairspray.
Final Net has no aerosol propellants. Use non-aerosol Final Net. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It's so interesting to me that this became a sort of consumer-level public scare. Now, you said that, you know, the public was much more frightened than the scientists, who were not necessarily afraid for their lives when they were doing research in Antarctica. Such an interesting sort of shift in what we've heard today. Why do you think it gripped the public so?
I think it was a combination of factors. First of all, we knew that ozone existed, that there was an ozone layer, but it was still relatively new in terms of scientific inquiry. We had only just developed the satellite imaging tools and, you know, different ways to measure ozone in the atmosphere. So it was really new, and there wasn't a lot of information on it. I think also it's just so tangible. You know, I mean, going into your bathroom and lathering up with shaving cream feels really visceral and is just right there. It's something very everyday. And so being able to make that direct connection, I think, really played into those fears and that impact.
Hmm. Well, CFCs were banned in the U.S. in the late 70s, 1987 globally. But now we rarely hear about the hole in the ozone unless, you know, maybe you're in New Zealand or something. How bad is it today?
It still exists, but we've actually made a lot of progress. And the scientists I spoke with, their message was one of hope. And back before the Montreal Protocol was implemented, the thought process was, okay, if things keep going at this rate, if we keep depleting our ozone the way we have been, the hole is going to grow by 40% by 2013. And instead today, it's actually expected to completely heal and close up by 2050. So that's a really different picture.
Mm-hmm. And that Montreal Protocol was when the worldwide ban on CFCs.
The Montreal Protocol, which was the agreement that, you know, eliminated CFCs or virtually eliminated them worldwide, was really fueled by these discoveries that were happening while the negotiations were going on. And so as scientific information kept coming in and as the public kept getting more and more freaked out, that really drove the change. That drove the political action that, you know, now we're seeing. It's really healing the ozone hole.
Well, so this is a victory, right? You know, scientists made a case. Policy changes pretty much instantaneously adopted. People responded on the, you know, on the ground level. So why then is this behavior such a concern for scientists today?
You know, it's one of those huge ironies. You'd think that, you know, we'd all be pumping our fists and saying, yes, we did it together. We closed the ozone hole and we're doing it right now. But really, it's a victim of its own success. Obviously, the hole is closing. That's great news. But I think what it really does is it affects the broader conversation about science, because I think it kind of fosters a complacency among the general public, thinking, all right, well, we haven't really heard about the ozone hole anymore. Obviously, we've done something about it. Problem solved, you know, and it's kind of like checking that box. Whereas, you know, the current challenges we face in terms of the atmosphere, CO2, greenhouse gases, global warming, climate change, those are all things that happen on a much longer term scale and really require different kinds of action. You know, we can't just solve that problem with a protocol that we quickly implement. Mm-hmm. We are going to have to, you know, as humans, make a lot more concrete, tangible changes in our daily lives. And it's not going to have the effect that just eliminating CFCs has. It just takes a lot longer. So I think that it really creates almost this false equivalency, like, oh, well, we solved that. So, you know, it's, we don't really need to freak out about this problem. Hmm. And it's really unfortunate, I think, that we are willing to rest on the laurels of one scientific victory and not, you know, use that as an excuse not to push ahead to the next one.
Erin, what you're bringing to mind for me is also the idea of like how panicked people can be. I mean, of course, there are a lot of things that raise the hackles and fears of your average voter. But it's interesting that even dire, you know, grim predictions by climate scientists have not done that. I'm just wondering if you think the newness of science, maybe the, you know, living in the nuclear age, the Cold War, do you think that actually influences how people respond to fearful things?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what kept people up at night in the early 80s? It was either nuclear holocaust or the ozone hole. And we just don't have that dire kind of external pressure in terms of a looming international warfare scenario right now. And so I think that that changes the way that people respond to a lot of different happenings in the news or different types of research that come out. But I also think the ozone hole was really personal. And the scientist I spoke with, who he's a person who monitors the ozone hole, he compared it to, you know, here are the three phases of climate atmospheric freak out. The first phase was acid rain. Oh my God, there's acid rain. We've done this to ourselves. Acid rain was really simple to solve. We solved it quite quickly. And that was really scary, but it's something that science was able to address. Okay, so what about the ozone hole? We addressed that pretty quickly as well. And that had some really scary effects, but that was also relatively quick and simple to address. Then you move on to climate change and greenhouse gases. And that's a much bigger question. It's so complex. It takes a really long time to fix. And it's almost like freak out fatigue.
So interesting. And thank you very much, Erin, for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Erin Blakemore, she's a journalist, historian, and author of The Heroine's Bookshelf. She blogs daily for Smithsonian.com, and that's where we found her post, "The Ozone Hole Was Super Scary, So What Happened to It?" You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we're going to stay on this theme of answering questions about our environmental history, and one that you may have never thought to ask. When and why were plastics first invented? Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible has the surprising story behind one of today's most ubiquitous materials.
We live in a post-billiards world. There was an age of billiards, and it has been over for so long, most of us have no idea how huge billiards once was.
100 years ago, there were 830 pool halls in my city of Chicago. Today, Chicago has fewer than 10 pool halls.
That is Dan Weissman.
So, billiards. Not what it used to be.
But this is a post-billiards world in a much more profound sense, because the growth of billiards led to the development of a material that, for better or worse, came to define the modern world.
I just want to say one word to you. Plastics. This story starts with a guy named Michael Phelan.
Really the father of American billiards.
That's Michael Shamus. He's the author of the Illustrated Encyclopedia of Billiards.
Phelan was a brilliant player, but he also raised awareness of the sport, promoted it.
He took the money he had won playing billiards and writing books on billiards and used it to become the first big manufacturer of billiard tables and equipment.
Phelan created the age of billiards in the U.S., and he felt that to further popularize the game of billiards,
you would need to standardize the gear. Because if tables and balls weren't the same from one location to another, well, you were basically playing a different game every time you went somewhere new.
But standardizing the billiard ball was no easy task.
The billiard ball has to rebound properly. It has to be of uniform density.
And at the time, there was really only one material that would do, ivory. Nothing was as good. And not only that, billiard balls had to be made of 100% solid ivory, and therefore...
The average number of billiard balls that could be obtained from a single tusk was 3.
So billiard balls were very expensive.
The entire trade depended on the shortage of this one exotic material.
That's Robert Friedel, a professor at the University of Maryland.
Phelan and his colleagues were acutely aware that their dependency on ivory was not ideal.
They're really desperate to find some kind of substitute material.
Phelan takes out an ad in the paper, and here's a dramatization of what happened when a guy named John Wesley Hyatt found that ad.
Prize of $10,000 for the discovery of a substitute for ivory in making billiard balls.
In terms of wages people earned at the time, it was like $3 million.
Hyatt worked for years to win Phelan's prize.
By trade, Hyatt was a printer, and printers use nitrated cellulose to protect their hands. It's still sold as liquid bandages. In the radio dramatization, Hyatt gets his key inspiration when a bottle of the stuff overturns, and he watches it dry into a film that he finds interesting.
Why, this bit of film has given me an idea.
John Hyatt and his lab assistant, Jim, kept going. They'd heat up the nitrated cotton, put it in the press, and...
Look, Jim, a material that would take the place of ivory.
And the material that would take the place of ivory was plastic.
Hyatt called his new material celluloid, but celluloid did not win Phelan's $10,000 prize.
It has a wonderful range of uses, but billiard balls was not one of them.
By the time of World War I, the ivory supply crunch had arrived.
And around this time, the real significance of Hyatt's celluloid had begun to show itself.
It began to inspire people to think about what artificial materials people could invent.
In 1907, a chemist named Leo Baekeland comes up with a new kind of plastic. He names it Bakelite.
And one cool thing about Bakelite, you can melt it, mix in fillers.
And it turns out that with that capability, you can vary the density, you can vary the elasticity, and you can make a perfect billiard ball.
And so they finally replaced ivory balls with this new plastic, Bakelite.
But by the 1940s, pool had passed its peak. It crashed as the Depression began. Never regained its former prominence. The age of billiards was over.
And this post-billiards age, the age of plastics, had really gotten into gear.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible. Well, thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. also on our Facebook page and on Twitter. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you enjoy the podcast, please do rate it on iTunes. That's how things work. It helps others find it. And isn't it just that much better to learn about things by word of mouth? I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.